It's good to be here. Mother's Day. I was kind of hoping for coffee, flowers, sleep in. But it's good to be here and talk to you this morning. Well, May the 8th, I'm just going to try and get this down. May the 8th, 2011, that's what today is. Where, if you look back on your, think about today, look back on your life, everything about where you are now, the way you feel, where you live, your relationships, maybe your bank account, your health, all of those things about where you are right now, how many people are where they thought they would be? You are. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, you know what? You know what? But it's actually not uncommon that very few of us are where we thought we would be, because life throws us a lot of curveballs, a lot of twists and turns. And 24 years ago, I grew up in Australia, and 24 years ago, I was signing up to go to Bible college for 2 years. I had had it with relationship with men. I was going to be a single woman off to Africa for the rest of my life as a midwife. So you can see I'm actually not in Africa. God had different plans. I came to Canada. I'm now married. I have 4 children. So life, I stand here and say life is very different to what I thought it was going to be. So not only is life different to what we thought it was going to be, relationships can also take twists and turns, and they can also be what we didn't think they would be. And we can experience things in relationship that we didn't think we would experience. So you know, last week, if you were here last week, we actually began a series on relationship. My husband last week gave the sermon on stages of relationship, and I'm going to continue to talk a little bit more about what he talked about towards the end of his stages. So what I'm going to do, first of all, actually, is I'm going to do a little recap. I'm going to recap in 1 minute what my husband said in 30. I think that I usually can do that. If that's okay, love ya. All right, so the first stage, who remembers what the first stage was? Celebrity stage. And this is when this was symbolized by a newspaper. This is when we meet, when we hear about, and this is our relationship with God. So we hear about God, and that's what celebrity is. The next stage? Acquaintance stage. So this was represented by 2 coffee cups. We go out for coffee. We now meet. We've moved from hearing about. We're now meeting. This one here. Anybody remember what the next one was? Friendship. Friendship with God. It's a little bit different to relationship. We're now in a friendship. And so this was symbolized by glasses, maybe more than coffee. We're now doing dinner. And tennis, camera, kind of doing life, growing in love, growing in trust, and that's friendship. This stage of relationship is what? Crisis. And this stage of relationship, where what Dan talked about here in our relationship with God, is that sometimes God doesn't do what we think he was going to do, or life, in fact, happens in a way that we thought it wouldn't happen in our relationship with God. And so we hit this crisis in the relationship, and we wonder, okay, what are we going to do? And so we have a choice in this stage that Dan talked about, and the choice was to press into the next stage, which is intimacy. We have a choice to go back to a more comfortable place in the relationship, or we have a choice to walk away. Okay, so the fifth stage was the cross, which represented intimacy with God. Now, I really want to say that it's important for us, before we begin this, it's important for us to see that this is not a linear track. Like, we don't kind of go here and then land here. You don't land at intimacy. Intimacy is like, is a relationship. It's something we grow in, something we develop in. It's something that God is always drawing us deeper and deeper into in different areas of our life. You may have intimacy with God in one area, and He's growing you in intimacy in other places. So He's continually drawing you closer. And so that's important for us to know. And that it's not linear, we flow in and out and of these different stages. And there's no shame where you are. There's no shoulds, okay? So God is not saying, you know what, you really should be here, when in fact you're somewhere else in relationship with Him. He is with you wherever you are in relationship with Him. And He is as present in each of these places to you. Okay, so it's not that we come along here and we get to here and suddenly God disappeared. God is as present in this stage of relationship as He is in the intimacy stage of relationship, as He is in all of these other places. We can feel that He's gone. We can feel that we have to somehow work it out. And so before we start actually going into looking at a couple of people that face Christ in relationship, I want to tell you that it's actually important for us to think about what you think about this stage. Because if you think you shouldn't have it, you're going to feel bad about being there. You're going to feel like I have to fix, there's something I have to do, there's something wrong with me for being there, for having these feelings, for having these life experiences, and so therefore I actually have to figure it out somehow so that I can get into this more intimate place with God. And so it's important for us to think about what we think about this place. Is God with us in it? Is this a part of relationship? If we see it as a part of relationship, then we can see no matter what we have in life, no matter what we experience in life, that God is using it to call us into deeper relationship with Him, into deeper intimacy with Him. And I think it's important, not just as individuals, but I think as a church community, I think we need to talk about this. And I think we need to be okay with this stage. I think we need to give grace to each other wherever we are. And we need to give grace to this stage. It's really difficult. You know what? It's easier to be around people that are in the friendship and the intimacy stage. It's hard to be with people that are in this stage. This stage is messy. This stage can be painful. But this stage needs Jesus just as much. This stage is where we need to be present as the church just as much. And so it's important for us to be, as the church community, okay with this. To be okay with the messiness, the questions, the confusion, the pain, to encourage each other to face God in the context of our lives. Because it's in the context of our lives that God meets us. He uses what is happening in our lives to deepen our relationship with Him. So what we're going to do as we look at this crisis going to intimacy is we're going to look at two stories, two healing stories of Jesus in the gospel, and see how Jesus met them, see what they brought, see what their challenges were, see what their crisis was, and see what we can take away from this. So what we're going to do is we're just going to start reading. I'm going to read the story of Jairus and the bleeding woman. And this story is in three Gospels. We're going to read from Mark 5 that has the most information. So this is why we're going to choose Mark today. It should be on the screen or in your pew Bibles in front of you. Okay, so Mark 5. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around Him while He was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at His feet and pleaded earnestly with Him. "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around Him. and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up from behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and he said, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. Okay, let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that you are the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus, the stories that we read of you in the scriptures are real for us today. You are the same Jesus. You are the same God. You are the same healer. You are the same one who welcomes us, who meets us in our pain, who desires to reveal more to us. God, I ask that as we dive into this story, that we will see you, that we will see more of you, that we will encounter you in a way that we haven't before. Because, God, you are life, and when we encounter you, something is birthed. Something grows. Something changes. Because you are creator and you are life. Spirit of Revelation, I just invite you here. We ask that you will come. And where this is a familiar story to many, I ask, Lord, that they will see new things today. And God, I pray that we will see the hope of pressing in to relationship with you when things are not what we desired or things are getting hard, that you desire to meet us there. So we give you this time, we welcome your presence, we acknowledge your power, and we look for you. Amen. Okay, so what I'd like you to do is put yourself in the story. We read the story. I'm going to go through the story, talk a little bit about the story. I love this story. I love the healing stories of Jesus. There's 26 healings, or individual healings that you read about. We know that Jesus healed many more people, but there are 26 individual accounts in the Gospels. They're all different. And so it's great to actually unpack them and see what is it that we can learn about Jesus and healing. So this is this story about Jairus and the bleeding woman. This is an interesting story because it's a healing within a healing, which means that, and this is the only one in the Gospels, so that means that we have Jairus at the start, so he's like a bookend. So we have Jairus at the start, And then we have the bleeding woman and Jesus' encounter with the bleeding woman, and then Jairus comes in at the end. So this is actually one story of two people. So as we look at this, I want you to first of all see that both of these people had pain and both of these people brought their pain to Jesus. Okay, so the woman has been bleeding for 12 years, and in order to, you know, we can say that and we've probably read about it before, but it's actually important to think about what would this have been like for this woman to bleed for 12 years? And so I think it's important to see. Sue and Larry Richards in their book, Every Woman in the Bible, writes, "This, a Jewish woman bleeding, would have been considered unclean. Any person she came in contact with was unclean. She could not go into the temple court. She could not light the Sabbath evening candles. She could not participate in Passover. She would have hovered as a ghost in her home, there and not yet there." We know that bleeding for 12 years affected this woman. We know that from the scriptures she was emotionally affected. She would have shame, low self-esteem. She was considered unclean. She had no hope. She was financially affected because she spent all she had. She went to the doctors, and that she got worse instead of better. Now, as a nurse, if somebody came into the hospital and I asked them, "Why are you here?" And she said, "Well, I've been bleeding," which is not uncommon. I work in obstetrics. "I've been bleeding." And I say, "Well, for how long?" She says, 12 years. That'd be a bit concerning. It really would be. Like, physically for her, not only emotionally and financially, but physically, she would be anemic. She would be prone to infection. She would be cold. She would be tired, fatigued. And we know also that socially, she was socially affected by this. She was isolated. So this woman was desperate. She was desperate. And she heard about Jesus, and she decided that if I go and I can touch him from behind, then I think I'm going to be healed. So that's exactly what she does. She comes up from behind Jesus in a crowd with the final hope that if she touches him, she will be healed. And scripture says that's exactly what happens. That immediately her bleeding stops and that she's freed from her suffering. Now Jairus also had pain, and he sought Jesus as his answer. But the interesting thing that we first need to see about Jairus is that Jairus is named. And there's not many people in the healing stories of Jesus who are named. Okay, so for example, the widow of Nain, the leper, the blind man, the centurion's son, the woman with the demon-possessed daughter, the man at the pool, and now we've got the bleeding woman. And now we have Jairus. So we have someone who's named. Not many people are named. So there's probably the reason why Jairus was named is because he was well-known in the area. As a synagogue ruler, he was well-known. So here we have someone well-known coming to Jesus, and his pain is that his daughter is dying. He's also desperate. For a synagogue ruler to come to Jesus for help he would have needed to be quite desperate for him to do that. The synagogue rulers there weren't warm and fuzzy feelings happening with Jesus. Jesus was healing on the Sabbath. He was hanging out with sinners. He was preaching forgiveness of sin. And so for a synagogue ruler to come to Jesus in public and fall at his feet demonstrates how desperate that Jairus was. So Jairus' plan is that he believes if Jesus could come and lay hands on his daughter, that she will be healed. The other thing that we see in this story is that both of these people fall at Jesus' feet. Jairus falls at Jesus' feet at the beginning of the story. There's a large crowd. He publicly comes and he asks Jesus to heal his daughter. And in doing this, Jairus is acknowledging Jesus as authority, his belief, and his dependence on him and the healing power of Jesus. The woman, she's interesting. She also falls at Jesus' feet. She falls at Jesus' feet when she returns. And it says that she falls at Jesus' feet in fear and trembling. So why was she there in fear and trembling? The woman touches Jesus. We know that. We know that she was freed from her suffering and she was probably heading away. And then Jesus does something that she didn't expect. He stops walking and he turns to the crowd and he says, "Who touched me?" Jesus calls her to respond. This is quite interesting again to think about. Luke has this amazing verse in his account, and he says that this woman knew she could not go away unnoticed. So here was a woman who for years was being unnoticed. She'd been bleeding for 12 years. She couldn't do what she was normally able to do. She couldn't touch people. She couldn't be part of the Passover, the temple, all of those things. She was a ghost hovering in her own home, and Jesus was noticing her. She could not go away unnoticed. That's amazing. It was from this place that she fell at his feet in fear and trembling in the presence of all the people and told him the whole truth. So both have pain, and they saw Jesus as their answer. Both fell at Jesus' feet, and both experience fear. I think that's really important for us to see. Fear is actually not uncommon. All of us probably, to some degree, have had fear. Is that fair to say? And so it's good to see both experience fear. The woman, as Jesus stops the crowd and she realizes that she can't go away unnoticed, her fear surfaces. Probably her shame as well. I'm going to be exposed. I shouldn't have done what I did. Everyone's going to know. She's feeling guilty. She's feeling ashamed. She's afraid. Now, put yourself in the story. Wouldn't you be tempted to just leave? Hello? Wouldn't you be tempted to just leave, right? She got what she came for, don't you think? She came up from behind, she wanted healing, she knows, it says, that she was freed from her suffering. So wouldn't you be tempted to, like, I would be, but something drew her back to Jesus. She had received a touch from him. And when he stood there in the crowd and stopped the crowd and she couldn't go away unnoticed, something in her drew her back. She wanted more. Her relationship with Jesus prior to her crisis enabled her to go back to him in this place. Amazing. Her fear was others knowing of her past and finding out what she'd done. I want you to think about that. It's interesting that it's what Jesus did that stirred up her fear, guilt, and shame. Ever thought about that? It's what Jesus did that allowed her fear, guilt, and shame to surface. Now, he didn't give it to her. He didn't give her fear. He didn't give her shame. He didn't give her guilt. He knew she carried it. He desired to minister to it. He does something to allow it to surface. And I think sometimes in our own lives, God does the same in us. That he knows what we carry. He knows what we carry in our heart. And he gives us experiences where these things surface. And rather than feeling shame about them, or somehow I've got to fix myself, to be able to see, God, what are you doing? How is it that I can see you and experience you in these feelings? And she goes back to him. Jesus stirred up her shame, fear, and guilt because he desired to meet her in deeper places than just physical healing. He knew what she carried for years of isolation, of not being helped and feeling hopeless. She chooses to face him. She falls at his feet in fear and trembling, and she tells him the whole truth. Jairus, his fear is encountered as he learns that his circumstances have changed. And I think that's not uncommon for us either, that we have changing circumstances that happen in our lives and we can experience fear. As Jesus is finishing with the woman, someone from his house comes and tells him that his daughter is dead. And scripture says that right at that time that Jesus turns to Jairus and he says, "Don't be afraid, just believe." So why did Jesus say this to him? Don't be afraid, just believe. You know, do not be afraid is mentioned several times in Scripture. You can look it up. It's over 100 times the particular words, or even the theme is, they say, over 300 times. And fear impacts our faith. And God knows this, and he knows how much we go to a place of fear. But you know what? When God says to us, do not be afraid, it's not a condemning, finger wagging, do not be afraid. You know what? You got to stop doing that. You really got to stop. It's not good for you. It's really this place of, you don't need to fear. I am here. You don't need to fear. I love you. You don't need to fear. I know what's going on. You don't need to fear. I'm in control. You don't need to fear. I'm Jesus. I'm God. I'm with you. And so Jesus says to Jairus, you don't need to fear. Keep believing in me. Keep believing in me. Think about what Jairus was witnessing. Jairus would have witnessed Jesus' encounter with the woman, because he would have been walking with Jesus. He would have witnessed the woman, Jesus stopping the crowd, who touched me? The woman coming up in fear and trembling, giving the whole truth. Here's a synagogue ruler listening to the whole truth. He could be going, whoa, unclean woman, you touched Jesus? Whoa, not good. He's listening to all this. He's listening. He's listening in the context of his story. And he sees Jesus' encounter with this woman. He sees Jesus say to this woman, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. One commentator writes, Jesus spoke into the crowd not for the sake of his honor, but for the glory of God, the commendation of the woman's faith, and chiefly for the strengthening of the faith of Jairus, with whom he was going to raise his daughter from the dead. Here's two people who wouldn't normally come to be seen together. And they come together, they're seen together with Jesus, and one is used to strengthen the faith of another one. The story of the woman gives the rule of faith for Jesus to work in his life. Powerful. We need to share our stories. We need to hear each other's stories. Both come to know Jesus in a deeper way. The woman, her plan for healing was to touch Jesus from behind and then leave. Her plan fit the way she felt about herself. But God's plan is about who he is and how he feels about us. The woman experienced physical healing, and now Jesus was healing her in deeper places. In front of the crowd, he says to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. And that word peace is a word of wholeness. The other thing I want you to notice is he calls her daughter. Jesus doesn't call anyone else in Scripture, in the Gospels, this word, daughter. And here she had just poured out all of her life, all of the things that she had done, probably her shame, probably her guilt, probably her fear, all of those things. And Jesus, the first thing he does is he says, daughter. And that word is a word of kindness and tenderness and affection. And that is the way that Jesus desires to first meet her. He doesn't condemn her. He doesn't rebuke her. He commends her faith, and he speaks kindness to her. This woman needed this. She needed identity. She needed kindness. She needed him to speak to her. The woman came privately and left publicly. She came from behind, wanting to leave secretly, but Jesus called her out. He named her in front of a large crowd. Everybody would have heard that. He names her in front of a large crowd. Intimacy is knowing Jesus, encountering Jesus in deeper ways, so that we're changed and our lives are transformed. She wanted to experience Jesus as healer. She wanted to come up, touch him from behind and leave. But she came to experience him as healer, redeemer, lover of her soul, and friend. As she pressed into relationship, as she pressed into that place of coming to him in that pain, she experienced more of him. Jairus came to know Jesus in a more intimate way. Jairus's plan was for Jesus to come and lay hands on his daughter and heal her. But his daughter dies. Don't you think when the notice came that she had died, do you think that he would have said to himself, oh no, I wish people wouldn't interrupt me. I was kind of on my way to seeing the girl. Now someone's used up my time. I've now got to raise her from the dead. Like, do you really think that he would have been surprised? He wasn't surprised by the girl's death. He wasn't unsettled by the girl's death. He wasn't, oh, I wish people wouldn't interrupt me. I was on my way there. Like, can we just do one thing at a time? Really? He didn't. Jesus is not unsettled by changing circumstances. You need to hear this. He is not unsettled by things that are a surprise to you in your life. Someone comes and says, don't bother the teacher anymore. Jesus is still calling us closer in our changing circumstances. He's inviting us into relationship and he's inviting us to turn to him to reveal more of who he is in these places. Jairus, the known synagogue ruler, came to Jesus. He came in public. He's the opposite to the woman. The woman comes in private. She leaves in public. The Jairus comes in public. He leaves privately. He's a private encounter. Jesus dismisses two large crowds in his encounter with Jairus. Following Jesus' invitation, don't be afraid, just believe. Jesus immediately dismisses the crowd. That's kind of interesting. Jesus, and that would have been the woman. It would have been the people that came to Jairus and said, your daughter's dead. It says that Jesus dismisses everybody but Peter, James, and John and Jairus. So the five of them now are walking to Jairus' house. So now we have someone who came very publicly in a huge crowd, kneels at Jesus' feet. There's an incident that happens and Jesus says, okay, everybody, bye-bye. We're going this way. And Jairus now begins this private personal encounter with Jesus. Now when they get to the house, there's another large crowd. Interesting, Mark points out that there's another large crowd mourning the death of Jairus' daughter. Jesus also sends this crowd outside. So here's a second large crowd that he says, outside, everyone. And only Jairus, his wife, Peter, James, and John are present. Jesus takes the girl by the hand. Remember Jairus' initial request? Lay your hand on her and she will be healed. And Jesus takes her by the hand. And he heals her. He raises her from the dead. But the interesting thing is he gives strict instruction, strict orders for Jairus, don't tell anyone. Okay. We got a crowd that we've just sent outside, who's been probably professional mourners. They are, they know that the child has died. Jesus has raised the child from the dead. Probably they're going to know within a few minutes, half an hour, that she's alive. So why do you think Jesus said to Jairus, strict orders, like he was pretty firm, strict orders, don't tell anyone. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? I think it's because, again, it's related to this personal encounter, that Jairus was this very public person, and Jesus came and he said, I know you. I care about you. Jairus, this is between you and me. They're going to know. But you know what? This is between you and me. You don't need to talk about it. It's okay. This is my relationship with you. You're going to ponder this deep in your heart, Jairus. Jairus asked Jesus to heal, but he came to know him as intimate friend, resurrection and life, and power and authority. Jesus is an individual relational God. He knows us and he will relate to us differently. When we come to him, he may not always give us what we want, but he's always going to give us what we need. Both choose to face Jesus and experience more of him than they expected. Both had the opportunity to walk away, but chose instead to press into relationship. Jairus, with his changing circumstances, when he hears his daughter has died, he could have walked away. He could have walked away. Someone came and said, don't bother the teacher anymore. It's kind of too late. He could have walked away, but Jesus calls him closer in to trust him. With the woman, Jesus did something she didn't expect. And she began to experience feelings of fear, shame and guilt, and she could have walked away. She'd already had a touch from Jesus. She could have walked away. But she wanted more. He wanted to give her more. I love this story because this story is two opposite people. We have a man and a woman. We have someone named. We have unnamed. We have someone known in community, someone who's isolated. The synagogue ruler, a woman who can't get in the door. We have someone who comes publicly, and then Jesus gives them a private encounter, and someone who comes incredibly privately that wants to actually leave and not be seen, and Jesus calls her out in front of a whole crowd and says, you, daughter, your faith has healed you. Names her identity to her. She needed that in her private prison of pain and isolation. He gave her life publicly. So as you hear these stories, I don't know how you relate and where you relate, but I hear these stories and I go, okay, I can see me in there. I see me in there. I see me in this time of crisis and saying, God, where are you? I didn't expect this to happen. I'm feeling these things and I don't like them. Like they must be kind of bad, right? Like maybe I'll go away and I'll get them fixed up and then we can do the intimate thing later. I can see myself there. And you know what? As I tell a little bit of my story, I'm not telling it at all as this relationship expert. If you actually knew my life, you know that's the exact opposite. But God is healing me in relationship. I told you I was on my way to be in the continent of Africa by myself because I didn't want to do relationship. But as I have pressed into relationship with God, He has been healing me because He is the God of relationship and He can't do anything else. Childhood sexual abuse and silence left me trying to figure life out myself. I didn't know how to handle my pain or my emotions. I stuffed them, and by the time I was 17, I was bulimic. Now, I grew up in the church. My dad's an evangelist. I always joke and I say I was probably born in a pew. Felt like I lived there. One of the things I kind of missed in my experience of church is I miss grace. You know what? If you miss grace, you miss the heart of the gospel. I missed it. I don't know where I was that day and all those days it was preached. I missed it. And I missed process. And I missed struggle. And I thought that spiritual maturity was about the absence of struggle. You know what? I've actually realized it's about the awareness of struggle. That we live in a broken world. And that Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world. But I missed it. And because I missed it, I thought there was something terribly wrong with me. And that I had to fix myself in order to do this spiritual life. I had to fix myself in order to be in relationship with Jesus. And so I would do all these spiritual things. Because church was I had a lot of options as the pastor's daughter to do spiritual things. So I would lead things and I would do things and I would pray and I would read my Bible. And those things are great things. Let me tell you, spiritual disciplines are great and God uses us to draw us closer to His heart. And that was great. For me, I needed God to attend to my heart. I had a lot of shame and fear and I really struggled with who I was. Could someone love me and what was love anyway? Really? I would hear that God loved me and it was like, whoosh. Really? What's love? I'm not really sure. Got all kind of confused with my experience as a child. I carried a lot of shame because of my eating disorder and the abuse as a child. And in 1983, eating disorders became on the map when Karen Carpenter died. I was well into mine by then, for about 2 or 3 years, and so people began to talk about it, anorexia, bulimia, and I would be around people and they would say, oh, that's so disgusting. Oh, that's so disgusting. Oh, how could anybody do that? You must be really sick if you do that. And that's what I would hear. And that was the way I was coping. So I carried a lot of shame. I wanted to be like the woman. I believed in the healing power of Jesus, and I thought, oh, Jesus, if I can just get up beside you, if I could get behind you in the crowd and touch you, and then no one else can actually see me, and then I could go away and woohoo, that'd be great. And then no one will know. No one would know about my addiction. No one would know about the pain that I feel, and then I'll be healed, and then I can be with all the other healed people. That's the way I felt. Do not think like this. Hello. Hello. Okay. So anyway, one day Jesus showed up in my addiction and he said to me, I was in the bathroom in the middle of my cycle of bulimia and God says, you are worth more than doing this to yourself. I want to tell you, that is not the voice of an addict. Those addicts, I know there's people in here that have struggled with addiction. That is not the voice in your head. And God said, you are worth more than doing this to yourself. And he broke into my struggle. And I had a choice then to trust him. Years later, as sexual abuse memories began to surface for me, I stood here. And I just thought, God, really? Is this? How do I reconcile this? How do I reconcile this? And I faced God and I said, are you the God that my head knows, my heart needs to know? I feel ashamed. I feel unseen. For God so loved the world. I knew that verse. I wanted to know, for God so loved Andrea. And he said to me, I will give you the treasures of darkness, riches stored in secret places, so that you will know that I, the God of Israel, has called you by name. God was saying, I know your name. I see you. I have riches in your secret places. I have treasures in your darkness. I'm a redeeming God. Press into me in this place. I came for your brokenness. I am healer. I am redeemer. A few years later, I was at a conference, and the shame, the things that we feel, they go deep in us. And the thing, sometimes it's actually not uncommon that God, we have experiences and we feel these things again. And we feel them again, not because we didn't deal with them 3 years ago. It's because God is going deeper and he's allowing them to surface. And he's saying, you know what, I want your wholeness. I died for this. And I'm going to allow it to surface a little bit more. Will you give it to me again? And I came and I was at a conference and there was a lot of food at this conference and we met afterwards and the MC made this bulimia joke and everybody laughed. And I kind of went, ooh, ooh, ooh. And my shame came up. And I went to the MC afterwards, I knew him, and I went to him afterwards and I talked to him. And he said to me, don't be ashamed of the place Jesus found you. Because he's not. Don't be ashamed of the place Jesus found you, because he's not. He's not ashamed of where you are. Jesus is not ashamed of the brokenness we have. He came into a broken world. He walked among us. He loved us. He died for us to free us, to be with us. One last story. Sometimes when we bring things to Jesus, we think he's going to take them away. God, take it away. Take it away. Take it away. Don't want it. And a lot of the times, he doesn't always take it away. But what he wants to do is he wants to show up in it. And for me, I had fear. I had a lot of fear. Grew up with fear. Thought I was going to be hurt overnight. And I would not survive the night and that I would die. And I grew up with a lot of fear. I didn't want to be alone. And it struggled. And I would have a lot of anxiety being alone. I couldn't get anything done. And I thought, God, Take it away. I give it to you. Give it. Have you ever done this? God, I give you my fear. I give it. Take it away. And God didn't take it away. He didn't take it away. And I would ask God, all right, I would go forward for prayer. When people would, you know, what do you want to pray for? I'd say, I live with fear. And they would say that God hasn't given you a spirit of fear. He's given you a spirit of power, love, and sound mind. And I think, well, you know what? I know he hasn't given it to me, but I have it. So what do I do with it? Because it's not going anywhere. And so as I asked God to take it away and he didn't, I changed my question and I said, God, if you're not going to take it away, I want you to tell me what it is. And he said to me, fear comes when you believe something is greater than I am. And so then I thought, okay, God, I then want to know you. I want to know your presence, your power, you so great that I need not fear. And can you see the difference in it? That God wanted to show up in it so that he would reveal more of himself in it? So where are you this morning as we invite the worship team forward? I want to just ask you, where are you? There's no shame wherever you are in relationship. Where you are is where you are. I want to pray for those people of you that feel that you're in this place of crisis, or if you've been there for a long time, or you feel that God has been stirring something in your heart to turn to him, to face him with. You know what, when we talk about turning to God, what I mean is just being honest. Being honest with the way that you feel, with the experiences that you're having, with the feelings that you're having, and saying, this is me. This is the way I feel. This is what is happening. And I'm asking you, God, to be with me in it. I'm asking you, God, to show up in it. I'm choosing you, God. Show me how to walk this out. Show me how I can see you. Open my eyes to see you. And he wants to do life with you. He wants to do this place with you. So as Brad plays, if everybody can just, if you can just close your eyes, I'm just gonna pray. God, I thank you that you are a God of revelation, and I thank you that you're a God of relationship. I thank you that you're an intimate, loving God, that you know us, that you know what we need. God, you know our disappointments. You know our fears. You know the dreams that we're still waiting on. You know the questions that we have. Jesus, you are the same. You're the same God that desires us to come to you, that you are running. You say, come near to me and I will come near to you. God, I ask that we will encounter you in the context of our life. Thank you that you're always drawing us closer. As we sing, I'd like to give an opportunity for people to respond. And if you want to come forward, there is people here to pray with you. If you are wanting to turn to God in a particular area of your life, or you feel you've been facing God with something and you just want to say, I'm still there. I'm still going to face you, God, there. Maybe you can't face God. Maybe that's scary for you. and you'd like someone to just pray for you in that place. Or maybe you've been doing it for a long time and feeling that there's nothing. As I was praying earlier, I felt like the Lord was encouraging some of you to keep asking for healing. Keep asking. Keep coming. So as we sing, we just invite you to come forward, just to acknowledge that you're facing God. I knew I was going to speak on Mother's Day on this topic. I just thought, where are you, God? This is kind of not Mother's Day topic. And I was asking all week this week, God, why today? Your content, why this content today? And yesterday, he said these words. I want to be your lifeline. My body, my blood, you growing in me, me growing in you. I want to be the one you turn to for all that you face and feel in life. I can sustain you. It is my heart to nurture you. I will protect you. The mother's protecting, nurturing, comforting heart for their child is from me. Everything that is life, capital L, is from me. You are my child, and I love you. So I just pray that you will know today the incredible comfort of God, the incredible nurture of God, the incredible love of God for you. That you will know today of the arms of God around you, wherever you are in the context of your life, that he holds you. Go in peace. Amen.